Welcome to Chromatic Elephant, a podcast about race, trauma, and the impact of white body supremacy. Here are your hosts, Tyler Reitzner and Resma Menakim.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whenever you're listening to this. It's afternoon where we're at. That's so right. Welcome to an edition of Chromatic Elephant. I'm Tyler Reitzner.
I'm Resma Menakim. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to be with you, my friend. Really looking forward to today's episode. We're going to really dive into your work, quite frankly, and why you do what you do and what this movement we're trying to create of somatic abolitionism is and why it's important. And we're going to start by talking about the diversity and inclusion racket.
I've been wanting to get at this one, man.
I know, man. You're itching.
This woman, her name is Chandra Prescod Weinstein. It's a black woman. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I like this article so much is that one of the things that she did do you remember an old thing that they used to do in when they used to talk about diversity and white supremacy and stuff like that, where Peg McIntosh did the thing called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack? Do you ever remember that? Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack was basically all of the ways that white folks have advantages, right? They call it privilege. I don't call it white privilege anymore. I call it operationalize it exactly what it is, white advantage, right? And so she called it Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, and she listed like 100 different ways that white people have advantages, right? Mm-hmm. Simply for having a white body, right? Yeah. Not anything that they earn, none of that. Just simply being a member of the Lucky Sperm Club, right? Or the Lucky Egg Club.
The Lucky Sperm and Egg Club, they go a long way in our society.
Long way.
American life.
Especially if the whole existence of your being is predicated on your phenotype. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So you don't have to prove anything. It just is automatically given to you. And so this woman did that exact same thing for the diversity and inclusion racket thing, right?
Yep. And just to give a quick background before we dig too much, there's an article on our website. If you go to chromaticelephant.com and go to the resources page for this episode, you will see The Rules of Diversity and Inclusion Racket. That is the article that Resma is referencing by Dr. Chandra Prescod Weinstein. And it's on the Riveter, which I'm not sure the periodical, but it's theriveter.com. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're talking about. Go check it out. And now I'm really going to turn the mic over to you at this
point. All right. So one of the things I do in my workshop is I ask people to raise their hands if they believe in diversity. Mm-hmm. And depending on the crowd, but most of the time, if I do it at the beginning, everybody in the room shoots their hand up, right? Mm-hmm. Like faster than the speed of light, boosh, mm-hmm. right? Shoot their hand up. And I mean, you can hear a sound when they do it.
Yeah, I know, but I did it. The first workshop that you did,
because
do that again.
Yeah, because we have this understanding. We have a dual understanding of what diversity means, right? Mm-hmm. So then I ask them, how many people believe in inclusion? Boom, people shoot their hands up. And then I ask the last question. And the last question is, when you talk about diversity or diversify, right? You start with something first, right? Mm-hmm. So you start with something and then you say, okay, I want to diversify or have diversity from this thing that I'm starting with, right? Mm-hmm. And when the next question I ask is, what are we diversing from, right? What is the thing, what is the crux by which we say we need something else, additional things in this that we're going to diversify from. And when I say that, the hands start coming down. Mm-hmm. And the reason why the hands start coming down is that we all know what the standard is, but we never say.
Yeah.
And we operate as if, once again, when I talk about decontextualization, we operate in a decontextualized dissociative manner, right? So by the time we start talking about diversity, it ends up being collard green Wednesday or fried bread Tuesday or lutefisk Wednesday, right? All of these kind of ancillary things when we kind of begin to talk about culture.
Yep.
Because what we don't want to say is that we are diversifying from the standard that the white body is standard, is human, mm-hmm. right? We don't want to say that, right? Yeah. So what ends up happening is that the diversity in and of itself then becomes a racket, because the simple act of not saying that we are diversifying away from white body supremacy means that you automatically give comfort to white people. I have been to diversity trainings where you never say the word white body supremacy. You never say the word white supremacy. I've been through whole 8-hour workshops where you can go through and never say white supremacy.
I sat in a meeting with a group of people who were deciding how to spend money in community.
You said that. Yeah.
They're talking about, and these are people who are trying to figure out how to spend a significant amount of money right. to do trainings, to put together.
And these are the good white people.
These are the good white people, right? These are the liberal white folks
right.
like me. You know,
that's right.
We're doing it. We're out there changing the world, right?
Yeah.
Except when it doesn't get comfortable.
That's exactly right.
And so we have this gentleman who's a person of color. I don't want to get too detailed right. about it because he's talking about his programming to a group of white people
right.
in how to do diversity and how to do workforce recruitment and retention
mm-hmm.
for people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And not one time
yes.
is racism mentioned.
That's right.
It's all diversity,
that's
inclusion,
right. That's right.
and multicultural.
That's right.
And culture gets mentioned constantly.
That's right. That's right.
And how, and I'm sitting here, I didn't say anything for
that's
the
right.
first 20, 25
that's
minutes,
right.
and I'm just sitting here watching all of this going on. And finally, I asked the question, I'm like, how come we've been talking about this for 25 minutes and everybody's talking about how they're struggling to bring people of color into their workforce
right.
and how to be more inclusive to multiple cultures and blah, blah, blah. And you're talking about this as if this is some kind of puzzle.
Yeah, yeah.
And really, and no one's mentioned racism.
Right. Right.
And yet that's what's driving all the shit we're talking
that's
about.
That's right. That's right.
So like everything you're talking about is really about systemic racism.
Yeah.
And man, did everybody like shut up.
Yeah.
Nobody talked.
That's right.
And the guy in the room who was kind of, I could see his body language and he was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He's in a room full of white people
that's
who
right.
are uncomfortable.
That's
and
right.
we know how
that's right.
that makes people of color uncomfortable.
That's
not
right.
only uncomfortable, make them feel unsafe.
Right.
And then the conversation shifts to immediately. We can't do that. If we start talking about racism, people shut down. They don't say white people.
That's right.
They say people shut down.
That's right.
And so I push back. And it turns into this little bit of a back and forth for a while from my perspective.
Yeah.
Is this, like, I'm done,
right.
you know, not seeing things move.
Yeah.
And not because I'm woke, but because I'm a white guy struggling with this too,
right.
and I don't want to struggle anymore. I want
right.
community and resources
right.
that can actually do something
absolutely.
About it and want to do something about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And it was just amazing to me watching this happen where the white folks needed to feel comfortable.
That's right.
The person of color in the room he all of a sudden changed, like he had to play the peacemaker.
Right.
And it was interesting how the other white folks hid behind him as
exactly.
soon as that happened.
Do
you
racial
know what I'm caping. Talking about? Yeah.
Racial caping. That's what happens, is that racial caping is a protective mechanism. It's not a defective mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
It is a strategy that people of color use to calm white bodies so they don't get lynched. Not necessarily literally lynched, but lynched in terms of their vocation, mm-hmm. lynched in terms of their social access, lynched in terms, you understand what I mean?
I watched it unfold.
That's right. And so what happens is that when you land something like that, how can we be sitting up here talking about retention and what's happening in the workforce, and we never mention genocide? We never mentioned enslavement. We never mentioned white body supremacy. We never mentioned racism. How do we do that? Well, the reason why you can do that is because this diversity and inclusion stuff is a billions of dollar industry, yeah. right? People come in to this is why whenever there's a diversity workshop, people of color roll their eyes. This is why whenever there's a diversity workshop, white folks go silent, right? These are all protective strategies, right? But we want to talk about it as if that thing doesn't exist. If you don't say that the standard of this country or the standard of European Western countries is that the white body is the supreme standard by which all bodies humanity shall be measured. If you don't say that first, and that we are diversifying from that being the standard, and that we are including other cultures and the ideas, and not just their food, and yeah. not just their dance, but their worldview. The indigenous people of this country do not see the world the same way that the colonizers do.
Yeah.
Right? How do you include that into the structural apparatus of your organization? If you're not talking about that, then you're talking about performance art. Mm-hmm. If you're not talking about that, then you're talking about making certain people uncomfortable and other people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. If you're not talking about that, you will not be able to retain people in your organization. Why? Because eventually people of color get sick and tired of being sick and tired
yeah.
of working with your white supremacy and your white body supremacy and not willing to acknowledge it. And so after a while of dealing in this system and being ground into dust over and over and over again and being sick and calling in sick and having stress responses and low birth rate babies and all of that different type of stuff, I don't want to deal with you, mm-hmm. right? Yes. And so the reason why I love what she did is she took 50 different things and said, this is how the racket works, mm-hmm. right? And she broke it down and it was so beautiful. One of them was white allies always should get milk and cookies for being human, for trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
I was trying to remember.
Yeah. So not the people who've been working to combat white supremacy. Not the people who've been trying to create a somatic abolitionist worldview. And when I say somatic abolitionist worldview, what I am saying is that white body supremacy has affected my body. It has affected my endocrine system. It has affected my musculoskeletal system. It has affected the way that my heart processes things. It has affected the way that my liver processes things. It has affected every system of my body. White body supremacy has affected it.
Yes.
And so my thing is that we need to be about the work of somatically abolishing white supremacy as a standard in the white body, as a standard of beauty, as a standard of intelligence, as a standard of what's right and what's wrong. That has to be abolished, and it has to be abolished from our bodies through culture, right? And through embodied anti-racist practices, not anti-racist thought, mm-hmm. not anti-racist ideas, not anti-racist strategy, embodied anti-racist practices.
That's great. Action.
Action. Not what you think. Something that I really like that you've done is you talk about when it comes to trauma. You talk about stop talking about trauma-informed and start talking about trauma responsiveness, mm-hmm. right? How do you respond to the trauma? Don't tell me how much information you got about it. Right? Don't tell me if I see one more white person get up and talk to me about the damn ACEs study, I'm gonna choke somebody out. I'm going to choke somebody out.
Well, then remind me never to not. but no, you're right.
The ACEs study is fine. But if you don't have any way of turning that information to operational practices, once again, it's performance art. It's
exactly.
You know what I mean? It's exactly. A way for people to make money or a way for people to be comfortable.
I do ACE trainings. That's why we're kind of laughing. And one of the things, but I also, so for me, I really truly believe that ACEs and adverse childhood experiences, and it's been my experience as someone who's dealt with PTSD and trauma, that they are the beginning of a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
They were a good entryway for me to start to understand how ecosystems of adversity affect us as we're growing up and developing.
Yeah.
And so it's just a piece.
That's right.
And that plays out every single time I do just a regular ACE presentation, which is really far and few in between nowadays. I'll do it in front of a couple hundred people, and white folks will always come up to me, and we've talked about this before. White folks will come up to me and start talking about their childhood, their parents,
right,
like mom and dad.
Right.
And right. I lived through this and that and da-da-da. And it's like, that's great.
Right.
And I get it. That's hard. That's not diminishing that, right. But there's more to it.
That's exactly.
And so, and that comes out when people of color come to me, whether it's black people, whether it's indigenous, whether it's Latinx, mm-hmm. Latino, mm-hmm. Even LGBTQ
mm-hmm.
women,
mm-hmm.
they will come up to me often and talk to me about being marginalized, not just by individuals, but by systems.
That's right.
And that's just as abusive mm-hmm. it is. And I've experienced pretty extreme poverty in my lifetime. And I can tell you, people treat you so differently. That shit hangs with that's you right. in your that's nervous right. system.
And people treat you differently if you're white in poverty compared to if you're black.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm telling you from my experience,
that's right.
it stays in your nervous system.
That's exactly right. That's
so
exactly right.
And so for me, this applies to, it's starting to apply to almost everything. Like
yep.
the idea of the somatic abolitionist
mm-hmm.
is, it's the only real way I can see to, and it's because of my experience with trauma
right.
with ACEs. Like,
right.
yeah, this is really the only real way to,
right.
to heal so that I stop hurting people.
Right.
Not just in huge things like racism,
right.
in huge things like sexism, in
right.
huge things like homophobia,
right.
like dealing with poverty.
Right.
These are ways in which I hurt people.
Right.
And the only way I'm going to stop that is right. if I deal with the
right.
somatic things
right.
going on. Because this stuff lives inside of me.
There's a tremendous amount of wisdom in the body.
Yeah.
Right. The body has wisdom. And sovereignty there, you know, and one of the things that happens is that people don't slow down long enough, both individually and culturally and communally, to develop a ear to actually hear what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
To actually hear what's happening to their bodies, like
yeah.
the wisdom that is coming up, that is emerging. We have not developed a resonant ear to actually begin to interpret what is happening for us, right? So
avoid it.
Yes, right.
I would tell you that. Yeah.
So one of the things you talked about earlier is this idea of part whole confusion. We confuse part of an equation with the whole of the equation.
Yeah.
So when people come and they watch your ACEs study or your ACEs presentation, they confuse that as being the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one small part of it,
yeah.
right? Having information without being able to operationalize it is a lot of times when I'm doing my work, what ends up happening is that I'm always trying to show people how to work it, right? Like in all of my embodied experiences, how do you work it? So here's this particular thing that I'm going to show you about, right?
Yeah.
Now, get together with your triad, with your three people, and work it while we're in here,
mm-hmm.
right? Actually work it. What now? Don't talk. And this is one thing that happens that a lot of what's a lot of the dodges that people use are is around constructed language. So when something happens, when they have an embodied experience, the first thing they want to do is talk to somebody about it. And with that, the moment that you start talking to somebody, what happens is it takes the heat and the possible growth right out of it. So when I'm in my embodied practices, when people go through an embodied practice, I don't let them talk first. I have them go away and what I call, what we call soul scribe first. So write on it, let it marinate, write on it in terms of the bimbas, the vibes, the images, the meaning, the behavior, the affect, feelings, thoughts, right? Sensations. And then work it themselves first. Work all of the reflexive responses. Work what's starting to emerge through what wants to come through, right?
Yeah.
And then do it with the other two bodies, right? Mm-hmm. Actually practice it in an embodied way.
Yep.
That, what that does is allow people to actually deal with the heat of growth as opposed to looking for comfort and staying pat, mm-hmm. right? And so in my work, in terms of somatic abolitionism, it really is about getting the body prepared to be able to hold and contain and do the things that we want it to do as it relates to race without getting rid of it, without getting rid of that heat, without getting rid of that pressure, without getting rid of that sensate, that felt sense that shows up that we want to get rid of by going to yoga or talking with my black friend about it, mm-hmm. or eating some kale or whatever, whatever it is that we do, or having a, here's a novel one. I can't tell you the number of people. So I'm traveling all over the country now, right? Doing these types of experiences. And one of the things that I find really interesting is that people who are reading my book as a book club, right?
Yeah.
And then turn around and feel like they can now do a workshop on my book.
Oh yeah.
Right? Not build community, not do the practices with each other, just read the chapters, right? Maybe tangentially do the practices, right? Mm-hmm. But feel so empowered. Not empowered, feel so entitled to everything that this black body has toiled for over 30 years to do, that you are now, you can teach other people about it and never tell me, never reach out and say, I want to develop community. I'd like to do some coaching. I'd like to think about this. Like, what are some things that you think might be helpful to this stuff? Not any of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I, because of who I am, I should be allowed to do that, right? And this speaks to what the sister's saying with regard to diversity and inclusion racket. That's what diversity and inclusion is now, right? Is that it is a thing for people to take and present to other people, whether or not those tools have been used to transform their own lives. Most of the times it's not.
It's not a practice. It's a lecture.
It's exactly
is
right.
What it boils down
exactly
to.
Right.
It's interesting what you just said too, because what popped into my mind is how many people since we've started this podcast.
Right.
And I use you, you've seen my.
That's right. That's right.
Trauma.
That's right.
I talk about you all the time. Right. And for two reasons. One, because your work needs to be brought out there. And two, because I don't want people thinking it's my work.
There it is.
You know what I mean?
There it is.
And people, because I've even had people come and say, you know, hey, will you come and do this? Or can you do this?
Right.
Or you do this stuff with Resma and this work. It's like, no, I do a podcast with Resma Menakem.
Right.
He does this work. This idea of somatic abolitionism is his.
Mm-hmm.
I can't come to you and teach you tell you how to practice
that's
it.
That's right. Absolutely.
And why I do it. Yeah. And I can work you through neuroscience
that's
on
right.
trauma and
that's
why
right.
this is important.
That's right.
That's the stuff
that's
that
right.
I do.
That's right.
But I just think it's And it blows my mind because I didn't really think about that. When we started doing this podcast, this isn't stuff I thought about.
Right.
I just thought about, I like how we talk together. I want to do this podcast with you. We got a good chemistry. This is good. This is important stuff.
We can
talk about trauma in a different way.
Right.
We can talk about, we can actually move the needle on race and trauma and dealing with this for real.
Yeah.
And what I've started to learn, especially again, white folks, is they come to me and say, hey, can you come and do some of this stuff?
Yeah.
It's like, no, that's not my work.
If
you want to have Rethman do it, he can do it. And it's like, oh, can you talk to him for me? And
I'm
like, what? What is happening
that's
here?
Right.
Like,
but,
I understand.
But that's the colonizer mindset.
Yeah.
That's the colonized mindset.
You come on, you can do this. It's like, no, I can't.
That's right.
I'm a straight white guy. Like, me talking to you, you know what I'm going to talk to you about is stuff you aren't going to like to hear. Because I'm going to talk to you about how racism is our problem.
That's exactly right. Exactly.
And I'm going to ask every person of, when I come to do your diversity training, going to seriously ask every person of color to lead.
That's exactly right.
Because I'm not going to put them through this.
Yeah.
And and then you're going to say, well, and then you're going to cry segregation,
because that's
literally what happens when we do this.
Not only are you going to cry segregation, you are literally going to cry.
Yes, right? You are.
If you're a white woman in a room, you're going to cry.
You're going to say
you're going to collapse, you're sick, you're this, you're that.
Yes.
Yep, that's what happens.
It's about practice.
That's right.
It's not about lectures. And even if you do cry, I've heard people say, well, we've had such.
She talks about that in the thing. She said, if a white woman cries, it's sad and we need to have sympathy for it. If a black woman cries, she is being aggressive or trying to escape responsibility. Mm-hmm. Right. White women's tears, over dramatic. Mm-hmm. White women's tears can move nations. Indigenous women's tears or black women's tears ain't gonna move a stamp, right? It is not gonna move anything. And we know that structurally, right? And so that's why she says it's a racket,
mm-hmm.
right? It's because this whole thing in terms of people coming into organizations, I mean, there are diversity, there are equity, DEI, diverse equity and inclusion officers.
Yeah.
In Google, in all of these words, right? Now, you mean to tell me that somebody at Facebook who is a DEI officer, this black woman, is going to talk to Mark Zuckerberg about the fact that his organization is predicated on the backs of indigenous people? He's going, well, what do you mean by that? Well, your organization has a headquarters, correct? That land people were genocided off of that land.
Mm-hmm.
That land was stolen, right? And if we're going, and not only should we acknowledge the land theft, right? Land acknowledgement, but we should probably do something. What would it be like if we thought outside the box and said, who were the people that were here? How can we give some of this land back? Mm-hmm. What can we? Oh, now you're being, right? When black people say we were promised 40 acres and a mule for us to be able to take advantage of the economic blood of this country,
mm-hmm.
we weren't given that. So now what we want to talk about is reparations. You're going too far now.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You're going too far, right? We let you people stay over here. So now you're talking about, I actually have to do something. See, this is where land acknowledgement and when presidents of the United States say, okay, we're sorry for enslavement and all that different type of stuff. To me, if there's no operational thing in terms of something that is done, It's like I keep saying, it's just performance art.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And so if you get a chance, please read this article. This woman, if I ever get a chance to see this woman, I am going to shake her hand. I'm going to tell her she put her heart and soul into that article. And you get a chance to read it. It will help your life. If you are in an organization right now and they're talking about diversity and inclusion and all of that different type of stuff, you need to read this article, because this article will give you words to what I know you're already experiencing.
And there you have it.
There you have it.
Another episode of Chromatic Elephant. And this is why we are pushing this movement.
Mm-hmm.
Somatic abolitionism is not... it's not for the faint of heart, it's something we need to do.
Exactly.
We need to evolve as just human beings in order to keep surviving. My name's Tyler Reitzner.
That's my minute, Kim. Keep growing, y'all.
Yep. Thanks for joining us. Take care.
Thank you for joining us on Chromatic Elephant. Support for this podcast comes from My Grandmother's Hands and Resma Menakem at resma.com, or text RESMAA to 55222. Support also comes from Thriver Institute, helping organizations in social services, education, and pediatrics find practical and culturally responsive approaches to applying trauma-informed practices. Live to thrive. Chromatic Elephant is produced and directed by Tyler Reitzner and Resma Menakem, with technical production by Noah Brown and Andre Gobert. Thank you for listening, and keep acknowledging the Chromatic Elephant in the room.